Chris Jimenez gets his first at bat of the day after Yan Gomes left. And there's a line drive base hit left field. That'll score Naquin. Here comes Almonte. And Chris Jimenez steps in and delivers a two-out, two-run single to make it a 4-0 Indians lead. Clobbered to deep center. Back is Santana. He's going to watch this one leave the yard. Tyler Naquin with his 10th home run of the year. He went down and golfed that baby to straightaway center field. And it's a 5-1 Indians lead.
It's a shoulder injury. We're going to get him back to Cleveland, get him scanned tomorrow, and we'll have more information. But until we get him looked at, just a shoulder injury. We're obviously going to DL him.
Should have gotten a live chicken.
Ventura sets the 1-1 in the dirt. Gets away from Perez all the way back to the screen. Castellanos in. We're tied at 2. Escobar shades up the middle. The 1-0. Swinging a fly ball right field. Way back in right and wow. Gone. An absolute no doubter off the bat of Saltalamacchia.
World number one making a Sunday move.
Well, she's not only world number one, she's the best putter on the LPGA Tour and taking full advantage of that strength.
There it is. At long last, her 14th win on the LPGA Tour. And it was indeed a marathon conclusion.
It's a tough green, and, you know, with the green firming up and the wind slightly, you know, helping, it needed to be, you know, some kind of shot that you could spin. And, you know, it was like deja vu the second time, you know, almost similar putts.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
The extravaganza returns indeed. Good Monday afternoon to you. Thank you so much for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo sports leader. Bob France with you today. Thank you for joining us. I am assisted, as always, by the very capable montage builder, Mr. Jim Kushlin, who is with us as well. Kush, how you doing?
Doing all right.
All righty then. Yeah, kind of an interesting weekend. The marathon is over. We had a great time out there at Highland Meadows on Thursday and Friday, broadcasting live the Marathon Classic over. So we got a little taste of that victory. And baseball winning teams over the weekend. Indians and Tigers both starting off the second half with a couple of series wins, Kush.
Yeah, definitely. But both the Tigers and the Indians taking 2 out of 3. And for the Tigers' point of view, that's a good one. They needed to keep pace, and it puts the Royals farther back. But the Indians did lose somebody in their 2 out of 3 wins at Minnesota. And by the way, can I just say, as an Indians fan, Bob, how nice it is to actually take a series from Minnesota, because that surprisingly is the one team up until now that
they
has actually given me
the hardest time with.
Yeah, they have the hardest time with, yet they have the worst record in all of baseball. It just fired their longtime GM today, because that's how baseball seems to work. But they lose Yan Gomes, and I know he was batting horribly. He's just had a horrible, horrible year, and finally breaks out of it. I think it was 0-for-27 slump in his first at bat. And then his next one, he separates his shoulder and, oh, let's tweak the knee for good measure.
Yeah, exactly.
One of those, if it can go wrong, it is going wrong. And that's why I had to throw in the Major League clip about the live chicken. Did you read that over the weekend?
I did. They were doing everything they had to do for Yan Gomes to get him out of that 0-for-27.
Joe Boo, the one whole chicken, just like you said, Pedro. And it was KFC style, too. And I guess they angered somebody, because the very next day that happens. Poor guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you better work, though. I mean, that's the thing, he got the hit.
Yes, that's true.
And the really frustrating part for him, for Yan Gomes, though, of course, was that it wasn't as if it was just swing and a miss.
Right.
He was, you know, the game before, he was hitting some shots just right at people.
Robbed at least twice, maybe three times in that game.
Yeah, and that's why they did it, of course. That's exactly why they did it. They're like, look, you know, the guy is so close. He is so close. He's hitting it. He's just not getting the breaks. All he needs is a break. You know, the ball to you know, ricochet the right way once. And obviously it did right off of the foot of the pitcher this time to get a double to break that streak. But whether the sacrificing of the Colonel's favorite chicken angered the baseball gods or not, I don't know. But yeah, they're going to be without Gomes for a while. Did you get a report on it?
It's a separated shoulder. The knee isn't that bad. It's the separated shoulder that's putting him on the DL.
No, but I mean, perspective. Is it a 15-day DL?
It's 15 right now. He was back in Cleveland for MRI and all that good stuff today. So I'm sure we'll get more information as the afternoon and evening goes on. But let's see. It's July 18th, separated shoulder, and it's his right shoulder. So that's the throwing shoulder. I know that matters more in a pitcher, but
I mean, think about where his value is. His value to that first place club right now is on the defensive side, not about obviously his bat, which he's of course struggled all season long. So for the sake of the Indians, they're going to miss him more if he can't be the guy behind the backstop, calling the games. For the pitcher, he's got a great relationship. It's the best starting staff in the American League, one of the best in baseball. And a lot of that has to do with the catcher, obviously.
Yeah.
We know Jimenez comes in, and he's been the personal catcher for Bauer.
Yep.
And that has worked out really well. But Gomes is the main guy behind the dish. So it's not really what he does at the plate right now. It's kind of like he's the embodiment of what they thought Lindor was going to be coming up. And that is an adequate hitter. And Gomes, of course, has been a good hitter in this
That's
league.
What's so frustrating about this season. We've seen how decent he can be as a hitter.
Yeah, he's been a very solid hitter. I mean, it's not like he's just, banjo punching Judy guy. He's been a very solid hitter. But point being is that, he wasn't contributing a lot at the plate this year, but he was still contributing in the field, which is what they thought Lindor was going to be coming up. And to see him just, be gone now, without being able to contribute on the defensive side is a tough thing for the Indians.
Yeah, and as a result, even though they weren't going to originally do it this way, now they absolutely need him, so they'll be activating Roberto Perez, who's been on the shelf basically all season due to various injuries, so they're bringing him back. He was already on rehab assignment a couple days early, so Indians fans, when it comes to the catcher position, get ready to see a lot of Roberto Perez and Chris Jimenez, because they haven't given a timetable, but separated shoulder, throwing shoulder, I'm betting it'll be a month before it's all said and done.
You might be right. You very well might be right. It could be that long, and obviously the good thing would be it's back in time for the postseason if there is postseason.
Yeah.
But they're trying to hold a lead. They got a 6.5-game lead over the Tigers, and obviously, as you pointed out, because the Tigers took 2 out of 3 from the Royals, it pushed them back a little bit. And
that's where the Indians are tonight, by the way, in Kansas City to take on those Royals. And that was a good series for the Tigers. You wanted to be able to start off on the right foot. They took 2 out of 3, get the always fun walk off yesterday. The only thing that I'm scratching my head on regarding the Detroit Tigers right now is that Justin Upton, a bereavement list right out of the break. So he missed the weekend. And, those happen with those couple of day things like that.
Sure.
But the corresponding move, and I'm still trying to scratch my head on this one, and maybe our good buddy at the Detroit Free Press booked him for Wednesday for the Tigers report, Anthony Fenical, shed some more light on why exactly was it that Stephen Moya got sent back to Toledo? Because right now, I don't know.
That's a very good question, and that is something maybe he will have some insight to, and we'll certainly ask that when we talk to him this week. By the way, speaking of catchers, as long as we're on it, how about Salty? Can you play that game winner again, that walk-off blast?
Sure. Let me cue
this thing. No doubt about it. I mean, talk about a great way to end that series, and obviously establish a little bit of momentum. And now, of course, the Tigers and the Indians flip-flop opponents. The Indians, of course, were just in Minnesota. Now Minnesota is at Detroit. The Indians are at Kansas City. So they kind of flip-flop opponents here for the next three.
Yeah, absolutely. And, for you Tigers fans, here it is again.
Escobar shades up the middle. The 1-0 is swinging a fly ball right field. Way back in right in.
Wow.
No doubter off the bat of Saltalamacchia.
That's a great call, a terrific call and a terrific moment, obviously, for Tigers fans. And, again, it allows them to hang in there and stay just 6.5 back, which is how they started the second half at 48-44 now. Indians still up there at 54-37.
The Indians are actually technically now tied with Texas for the best record in the American League.
Oh, yeah. Well, look at that. Well, actually, they're percentage points ahead, 593-591. 54-37 against 55-38. So technically, they're actually the best record in the American League, and the
Baltimore's only a half game back of that.
Tied for fourth best record in all of base. No, correction. They are.
No, it's tied for fourth. The three division leaders in the NL right now, I was just looking at, are all 600 winning percentage or better. And the Indians are, as you mentioned, 593 or whatever it is.
Giants are at 613, Cubs 604, Nats 602, and then the Indians at 593. So the fourth best record in all of baseball. So obviously still a ton of time to go. Corey Kluber, the all-star for the Indians, goes tonight against Kansas City. And they can really, really put some distance if they can do some damage at Kansas City. But it is on the road. It is on the road at the defending world champion. So
last time the Indians were on the road, by the way, in Kansas City, they were swept. That was right before the winning streak started.
That's right. That's exactly right. Before they started sweeping a whole bunch of other teams, which, of course, included the Tigers in that mess once and then nearly twice before the streak ended at 14. All right. So a little bit of baseball to kind of get the day started today right here on the Extravaganza. I want to open up the phone lines at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. But there are a lot of football stories that we want to talk about today as well. And Jim, are you familiar at all with Ballers, the HBO show?
I have heard of it. I don't have HBO, so I haven't got a chance to see a bunch of them. Oh, but right. I know
well,
of it.
Yeah, then this is probably not going to mean a whole lot to you. And I have not watched it either, but I was watching, or actually I was listening today to Russillo and Cannell a little bit, who, of course, are on right before we come on. And they're just reminding me of playmakers, and Ryan brought it up, and I'd kind of forgotten about that, and I was so angry, I was so disgusted by the National Football League back in 2003 when they did this. Now, for those who don't remember, Playmakers was a series that was actually produced by ESPN. It was a television series, a cable series. It was called Playmakers. Do you remember it at all, Jim? It's 13 years ago now.
I mean, it rings a bell. I haven't heard this one in a while, but I do recall this. Yeah.
You got to get better cable. That's all I can tell you. You know? I mean, honestly, you got to get better cable. You're missing too much stuff. Well, Playmakers was an ESPN produced series, a television drama series. It was about a fictional football league. Obviously, they couldn't use the NFL and they couldn't use any team names. So it was a fictional football league. I don't know if they called it like the, you know, I don't remember what they called the league now, but it was obviously a play in the National Football League, and the team was a city with a fictional name, mascot that they followed around. But it was about a professional football team, and the professional football team, they basically featured all of the little peccadilloes that, you know, professional sports deals with on a regular basis. And they kind of condensed it all into one team so that it could be followed more easily week to week. In other words, they had the player that was a steroid user and it was always trying to cheat steroid tests. They had a player who was a closet homosexual, didn't want any of his teammates to know that he was gay, but some did. And then how they reacted, you know, all of these things that we've seen play out over the last, you know, 13 years, you know, with Michael Sam being the first openly gay draft pick and, you know, the revelation that other players, you know, were gay during their career, but they stayed in the closet, didn't want it to be open. Obviously, steroids being an issue. Virtually all of the things that you can think of, you know, personality clashes between players, womanizing the one player who's, you know, trying to get busy with girls in the locker room, kind of like Daryl Strawberry. Just confirmed last week. I don't know if you heard that, Jim. Did you hear about Strawberry?
Yes, I did.
You know that, yes, he actually had sex with women in the clubhouse during games, not while he was on the DL and out of games, and not when he was just getting a day of rest, during games in which he played, during games in which it's like, all right, I'm batting sixth up this inning. I've got time. And he would just give a little note to a girl in the stands that he liked and send it with a clubhouse attendant. Here you go. Daryl would like to say hi. Come on down. And he would say hi. So I'm laughing about that. I probably shouldn't be, because that's really, really all kind of wrong. But my point being,
I think we're laughing because it's not surprising in the
least.
No,
it's not, is it? No, it's not. It really isn't. Well, anyway, Playmakers was really, really riveting television to sports fans and to fans of drama and to fans who know this kind of stuff goes on. Well, the NFL didn't like the fact that they also know this kind of stuff goes on, and even though it wasn't the NFL, it's the Professional Football League, and they just got livid, and they forced ESPN to pull it. They forced ESPN to cancel the series Playmakers, and I was really, really angry. I was angry at ESPN. I still am to this day, by the way, at ESPN for letting the National Football League bully them. But, you know, this is a revenue business, and ESPN needs the National Football League and the contracts that they have with the NFL, of course, to survive and thrive and continue to be the worldwide leader in sports. You know, there's a lot of other startups out there that have come on, you know, Fox Sports Radio and CBS, et cetera, and NBC and all of this stuff. So ESPN made a tactical decision to not anger their partner and, okay, they canceled the series. Well, it looks like they're really, really close to having that happen again. The Ballers series is an HBO production. So HBO, the only contract they have with the National Football League is Hard Knocks. You know, it's not like they're airing all of the games the way ESPN certainly was and is. So HBO produces this one, not ESPN, and it's a drama comedy. It's about pro football players' lives away from the field. And they rely on Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, who, of course, is a college football player at Miami, University of Miami. A lot of very realistic writing, cameos from players, you know, that are actually playing the game today. And the inaugural season is apparently a hit, and apparently Roger Goodell doesn't like the fact that it's a hit. It's very similar to the whole situation that played out with ESPN. The show stars Mark Wahlberg. He is the executive producer of this, and it talks about things that are of issue in the National Football League today, like what? Concussions, the financial side of the game. And it's kind of like I've seen it described, as a matter of fact, on CBS, it's described as a more serious Entourage for those who are Entourage fans. It swaps out Hollywood for the NFL and for South Beach. And it looks like the NFL is not a fan of this one and wasn't a fan of the first season, and they don't want their players participating. Wahlberg was on Mike and Mike on Friday, and I don't know if anybody heard this. He revealed, Donnie Wahlberg did, Mark Wahlberg, he keeps the brothers Wahlberg are, you know, sometimes interchangeable. Mark Wahlberg revealed that he has taken multiple calls and complaints from the NFL executives by phone. Wahlberg said Goodell, though it's unclear if he personally called the actor, who is a huge Patriots fan, by the way, Mark Wahlberg is. It's unclear if he personally called, but he had executives passing the word on to Wahlberg that he doesn't want him using active NFL players on this program. NFL Senior Vice President of Communications Natalie Ravitz denied on Twitter that Goodell ever called Wahlberg, but Wahlberg said on Mike and Mike that the NFL did indeed contact him and say they are not happy. Quote, the first season of the show, the only calls I was getting were from guys like Roger Goodell. Now, he said guys like. Does that mean it is Roger Goodell or people calling on Goodell's behalf? Guys like Roger Goodell saying, you can't do this, and various owners in the league saying the same thing. We were saying it's actually a good thing for the league and the players because hopefully you'll get the word out there with the crazy stuff and the financial side of it. And hopefully we'll get these guys to realize they've got to be more careful with what they do with their money. Because they're talking about players that go broke. They're talking about players that sign massive guaranteed deal. Well, they say there's no guaranteed deals in the NFL, but massive deals with a lot of guaranteed money. And how a bunch of them end up broke anyway because they're just too irresponsible. So the bottom line is Goodell has essentially tried to stop ESPN's own headline for a video that they put out was that Goodell trying to stop NFL cameos on Ballers. Based on the video clip alone, it's not clear if that's exactly what is going to happen, but in its first season, DeSean Jackson, Steven Jackson, Antonio Brown, Larry Zonka, retired Larry Zonka, Donnell Ellerbe, Jeremy Shockey, remember him, the former Giants tight end, Rashard Mendenhall, and there's a list of other guys, Victor Cruz, Lamar Woodley, Jason Pierre-Paul, Terrell Suggs, Julian Edelman have all appeared on the show. Back in January, Dwayne Johnson was spotted hanging out with Duke Johnson, as well as Torrey Smith, Navarro Bowman, and former defensive tackle Anthony Adams. And according to Wahlberg, this season features Dolphins defensive tackle and former Detroit Lion Ndamukong Suh, as well as Jarvis Landry, Dolphins receiver, Suggs, and countless Patriots. I guess the reason I bring all of it up is, once again, I see the NFL so worried about their brand. I see the NFL so worried about their image. And I see the NFL trying to control all kinds of things to protect itself, yet they don't protect themselves when it comes to the actual things that can damage their brand. They don't protect themselves. They allow collective bargaining agreements to be negotiated that give the players the power to dictate policy, that give the players the power to dictate discipline, that give the players the power to have 10-game suspensions for matters as serious as domestic violence, Greg Hardy, you know, down to 4 games. They've allowed a collective bargaining agreement to be negotiated that is in effect right now that allows them to punish Tom Brady for football deflation, which still isn't proven, for the same amount of games as these domestic violence committing players do. So it's just so much hypocrisy on the part of the National Football League. They're trying to control the entertainment world. They're trying to control what people think of the league, even through fictional stories about fictional teams within the league. And yet, when it comes time, you know, an opportunity to really help themselves in real situations, they drop the ball so repeatedly.
Yeah.
I'll never understand. One second. One more thought, Jim, and I'll let you get in on it. I'll never understand why they have gone so fervently for the last 18 months, 544 days, after their biggest star, the guy that might be, the best quarterback in the history of the game, for this ridiculous Deflategate thing. It is absolute nonsense, and they know it. And when the judge, the federal judge, originally threw out that 4-game suspension, all they had to do is say, okay, well, legal process has spoken. Everything is fine. We now are checking the balls more closely. We'll make sure we don't have any more, you know, repeat instances of situations like this again. That's all they had to do, is let it go. And instead, they went back at it and appealed again. And no, we're going to get our biggest star. We're going to embarrass him on the world stage, the biggest star in the league, the very likely greatest quarterback in the history of the league by the time he retires. We're going to go after him. That won't hurt our brand, but we're going to go ahead and try to shut down a production, a fictional television series on HBO, because we think that'll hurt our brand. I just sometimes do not understand how the NFL operates. Jim, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay, because, you know, on top of everything you just said, Bob, which is correct, I also think sometimes these things have a little bit of a, hey, squirrel, look over there, distraction kind of notation, because you're talking, you know, all this is always couched under, for the NFL at least. We got to protect the shield, protect the brand. Yet, at the same time, they're changing things about the actual game itself. You know, we've gone over, obviously, the extra point thing that they changed out. The moving of the kickoff, so there basically are no kickoffs anymore. And then here's the new one for today that I'm not really sure what to make of, except to think, okay, at least it won't take effect this year if they decide to do it. But then there's an arena football joke in here somewhere, because they're going to study the kickers and their percentages, and maybe we're going to narrow the uprights. I mean, you're trying to protect the brand. You do all these dumb things on the periphery, and then you're changing the game itself. And I can't stand this anymore. I just can't.
If, you know, it's I don't know, it's an odd way to bring this in, but if they're trying to improve the quality of the game by making it more dramatic when it comes to, you know, a team scoring the tying touchdown with 1 second on the clock and they're an extra point away from winning, and we're trying to make that extra point harder to make it more dramatic for, you know, for ratings purposes, because it's going to have more people glued, and it's, you know,
and they've already done this, and this already, of course, happened once in the AFC Championship game this past January. This kind of already happened, and the percentages show it out. The extra points are down.
But that's the point. If you think about it, that was one of the most discussed stories of the entire postseason. And I don't know what the TV ratings look like for that game, but I promise you it was amazing, as people were just so unbelievably glued to that missed chippy by Blair. What the heck is the kid's name up there in Minnesota who missed that kick? Walsh, I think.
Yeah,
it was.
Walsh.
You know, that's kind of what they're talking about here. And, you know, you mentioned the Arena Football League with, of course, the very, very narrow uprights that they use there in the Arena League with the nets on either side. And I'm not, they're not certainly not going to do that. But if they do make the game a little bit tougher to score, if they make it a little bit more difficult to score on field goals and on extra points, then maybe that pushes teams into making what decision? To go for it. You know what? That's a tougher kick. A 35-yarder isn't a gimme anymore because look how much more narrow the goalposts are. Let's go for it. And what's more exciting than fourth and four, you know, with the game on the line? Would you rather watch the kick or would you rather watch them go for it? And if you do want to see the kick or if they choose to go for the kick, it is certainly no gimme and no automatic the way it was anymore.
That's true.
So that's not a, you know, that's not necessarily a negative thing to study.
And I already know for a fact, by the way, that and this is before this possibly, because they're thinking what the story is. They're thinking of putting out researching a study to find out, you know, should we even do this? So the earliest this would take effect, right. The earliest this would take effect if they go this route would be for the 2017 season. But these kind of things are already changing how some coaches approach the game. The example that I keep thinking of on these situations is Mike Tomlin of the Steelers. There's at least three games last year where I couldn't help but notice that a first quarter score was 8-0.
Yeah.
Because he's like, well, if you're going to change these kicking things, then I'm going for two.
Well, yeah, and you know what? Ben Roethlisberger is pushing his coach to do it all the time.
Yeah.
He said, I'm going to go for two every time. We don't even need to try this kick stuff because I'm going to make at least half of them. And if you think about it, if we score four touchdowns and I make two 2-pointers,
that's still 28.
That's the same as like making all four of the extra point kicks. You know, so I can't remember who it was. There was another quarterback who came out and backed Roethlisberger and said, yeah, I feel the exact same way. We should go for it. It was last month. They talked about it. But Roethlisberger said we should go for it on fourth go for the 2-point conversion after every touchdown. And this, again, what does it do? Now, there is a counter argument to all of this, and that is the safety aspect. Why did they get rid of the kickoff, essentially, by pushing it up to the 40-yard line so that almost every one of them goes out of the end zone? Because of safety. We're worried about concussions. We're trying to cut down on the number of plays in which we have contact, et cetera, which is silly. It's a contact sport. But so a move to make the extra point harder, such as moving it back to the, you know, to making it like a 35-yard field goal now from the little chippy 20-yarder or whatever that it used to be, that discourages kicking and encourages 2-point conversions, which creates another collision play because you've got to play it that way. Narrowing the goalposts would do the exact same thing. It would discourage the kicking game and put it more on the players. Now, for like I said, there's a bit of the conundrum here for the National Football League is we do want the players to be safer, but yet we also want to make money. And games will be more exciting if we have less plays with kickers involving themselves and more plays with 11-on-11. Deciding first downs, touchdowns, extra points, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a, you know, it's a really interesting dynamic here. You mentioned they're going to study it, and they are. And here's what we know, at least from the initial reporting: NFL kickers have not made less than 80% of their field goal attempts in over a decade, nor less than 82.4% since 2009. So the last seven seasons. Possibly as a result of that fact, the NFL will now conduct the study to determine whether or not the uprights should be narrowed. That would be one way to affect both the extra point and the field goal, Dean Blandino, the president of officiating, said. Vice president of officiating said, success rates have continued to climb over the years as our kickers and the whole process become so specialized, from long snapper to holder to kicker. So we'll do some studies this year. One of them will include placing microchips inside kicking balls, so the NFL can study, among other things, how far inside uprights all successful field goals and extra points are kicked. As of now, the plan is to use those for the preseason, but the study goes well, and they'll use it into the regular season as well. So I got to tell you, I'm not as concerned about the safety aspect as some are, because I know these men all know what they've chosen for a career. And one or two or six extra plays a game in which somebody is going for it instead of kicking isn't going to decide or end somebody's career. In my mind, if they can increase the interest in the game by influencing a coach to go for it on fourth and two as opposed to kicking it on fourth and two because the success rates are down now because of a narrow goal post, because of a further attempt for an extra point, or whatever the case might be, I'm all for it. I think that's exactly what they ought to do. Because I want to see plays. I'll be honest with you, no disrespect to kickers and punters, but kickers and punters are just, you know, I mean, obviously they're called specialists, but they're borderline football players. They're not really football players. They're borderline, you know, they're soccer players who come out to the football field on Friday nights and kick the football team's field goals. The way it is in a lot of high schools, to be quite honest with you. And so to me, they ought to really start thinking about minimizing the role of the kickers rather than making them decide wins and losses as much as they do.
And you mentioned the soccer thing real quick. This is just a basic understanding of professional football, essentially, because all these kicking numbers got to where they were that prompted the NFL to do the field goal or the extra point thing, is prompting them to look into this. It is because the straight-on kickers, how Lou Groza, for you older Browns fans out there, the way he used
Don
to kick...
Cockrell. Don Cockrell. You don't even have to go back to Groza.
That's true. Yeah, because it was about the 70s and 80s is when they were filtering all these guys out. Now everybody kicks the so-called soccer style, and that's why the percentages are as high as they were. If every kicker suddenly went back to kicking straight toe like Cockcroft or Groza and all the others from back in the day, all the numbers would plummet back to earth.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's no doubt that certainly would be the case. The soccer style kicker, of course, which took over and obviously became much more successful, and that's fine. But like I said, if they can find a way to make the game more competitive from an 11-on-11 standpoint, rather than having it be decided by a snapper, a holder, and a kicker, I think it's a really good idea. All right, we need a timeout. We've rambled on long enough. 866-240-1065, the number to join us, 866-240-1065. Do you like the idea of the NFL moving back the extra point last year, and I think it was a success, and now possibly narrowing the goalpost to encourage more going for it on fourth down? We'd love to get your thoughts on that and much, much more as we continue the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
So right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed. 3:46. Thanks for joining us this afternoon on the extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, as long as we're talking about football and controversy, how can we not bring up Johnny Manziel? Kush, did you hear the statement that Johnny Manziel finally made as he broke his silence? Johnny Manziel, for those who don't know, he's on his way to the grave. And that's not according to a talk show host. That's not according to some hater. That's according to his father. His father said he doesn't think. He's publicly called him a druggie and said if he doesn't turn his life around. And there's nothing that he, his father, nor his mother can do about it, according to Dad. He's got to make the decision because they've done everything they can to support him and encourage him into getting help. But if he doesn't make the decision for himself to get help, he's going to not live to see his 24th birthday. He's 23 years old, right? Johnny Manziel, the former quarterback of the Browns. And that's just the path, because it looked and appeared as if there's just no interest that he might have whatsoever in turning it around. And he's been silent. He's kind of been in media blackout mode, like LeBron in the playoffs or something, for the last several weeks. Well, apparently he has broken silence, and he allowed his agent or his representative or somebody to make a statement to the Washington Post for him. This is a story, a CBS story about the Washington Post story that was written about him. There's a lengthy Post story, by the way. I mean, really lengthy. Talk about devoting a lot of time to somebody who's no longer in the league. But I guess what it is now, Jim, the Manziel story is a story because of what it represents. He reminds a lot of people, and I didn't see it in the story that I read, but it just kind of occurred to me as I read his tales, you know, the story told by the Washington Post about the rise and the sudden fall of this young, talented quarterback. It reminds me so much more every day of the Todd Marinovich story. You know, Todd Marinovich was a different kind of a kid being raised, you know, by his father. We know the story by his father to be an NFL quarterback from the cradle. Literally, when he was born, he was being trained to be an NFL quarterback. His father had some sort of strange obsession, some sort of strange mission that he was on, that he was going to turn his kid into a test tube experiment on how to build an NFL quarterback. And, you know, he raised him that way, and he didn't allow him to have junk food, and he made him run home from practice. Even if practice went 3 hours and they were 16 miles away from home, he's running behind the car, or in front of the car, I should say, with the headlights on. I mean, all the stuff that we've all heard about Todd Marinovich that kind of turned Todd Marinovich into a bit of a psycho. You know, he just was never allowed to be human. And when he went to college to USC, it all came out. You know, he was out from under his father's thumb for the first time, and he was living on his own at college. And, you know, of course, he turned to drugs and many other things. The tremendously talented left arm that got him where he was no use to him because he really didn't even want it by the time he got to the National Football League with the Raiders. Johnny Manziel wasn't raised that way, but he was spoiled. He was given all of the spoils of a well-to-do family. He was pretty much enabled to do whatever he wanted, to act however he wanted, almost the opposite of Marinovich in that way. But his hard-partying style, Manziel's earlier, Marinovich's later, have led them to the same place. Johnny Manziel is out of football and may not ever get back to football. Well, that was the story, essentially, of the Washington Post piece. And over the past 6 months, Johnny Manziel has done a whole lot of partying and a whole lot of clubbing and a whole lot of TMZ appearing because they follow him around because he's an automatic click. You know, he'll just turn. He's a click machine is what he is for TMZ's website. And so he finally spoke a little bit. He made a vow of sobriety back on July 1st. He said he is going to get sober. Well, here it is July 18th, and he made a statement again, which was in response to the Washington Post. They put this lengthy feature on him together. He was not interviewed for it, but he let his spokesman send in a statement to give everybody an update on his life, and this is what the statement says. Quote, I'm actually doing well. I have good friends around me supporting what I do, and I try to support them in what they want to do. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to kind of break this down line by line, because what you have is a guy who essentially has no interest whatsoever in staying sober. I have good friends around me supporting what I do, not helping me stay sober. I have good friends around me supporting me as I walk this path back to sobriety and normalcy and try to pursue my career. They support what I do, and I support what they want to do. In other words, leave us alone. We've got this. We'll do it our own way. That's what he said in the statement. According to Manziel's friends, he has been sober since July 1st when he made that pledge. But Manziel himself then said in the statement, that's not going to be forever. Quote, I'm not saying I'm never drinking again, but for now, just mostly being healthy. End quote. Apparently, this is a guy who doesn't understand what the 12-step program is. This is a guy who doesn't understand what sobriety is. You don't get to say, yeah, I'm sober for now, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to get hammered again later. And oh, by the way, he couldn't even say, I'm just trying to be as healthy as my body allows me to be. He says, for now, just mostly being healthy. So I'm going to drink again later. Now I'm mostly being healthy. I won't tell you what my unhealthy habits are, but this is where I am. He then went on to say, quote, I've got a killer gym at my house, and I can spend time working out. End quote. Now, I'm not trying to, and I know it seems like I am, I'm not trying to just pick apart his every word and destroy it. But you notice how he cannot say definitively what he's doing and what he plans to do? He said, I've got a killer gym in my house, and I can spend time working out. He didn't say, and I vow to spend all my time working out. He didn't say, I have been doing nothing but working out. He said, I've got a killer gym, and I can spend time working out. But he's not acknowledging or professing that he's actually doing that. He went on to say, and this is the big question, do you think he ever plans to play football again? First of all, if he does, if he ever gets signed again, which I cannot imagine. I said this, and I asked this, Jim, and you recall, virtually every guest we had on in the National Football League or about the National Football League when Manziel was finally cut, I said, do you think he has played his last down in the National Football League? Most of my guests, from Scott Petrak to Maniloff to Rodgers to virtually everybody, said, no, the league is starving for quarterbacks. If he can still play, or somebody thinks he can, he'll get another shot. And I said, I don't think so. I think he's done. I think he's never going to play another down in the National Football League.
And most of those, incidentally, I believe, were before the NFL came down and said, yeah, whenever you are playing again, you got a 4-game suspension to start with.
Correct, which is what kind of, you know, strengthens my point. You know, I don't know how many teams are going to sign him and say, okay, we'll sign you, and then sit there and wait for you during a 4-game suspension. He hasn't proven that he's good enough to be worth that trouble, to be quite honest with you, at the NFL level. So does he even want to play again? What he said was in his statement, quote, I'm interested in doing a lot of different things in my life, including football. But right now, I'm just exploring options and waiting to see what the future holds. Period. End quote. That doesn't sound like a dude who ever plans on playing in the National Football League again. What I was hoping to hear, and I say this not because, you know, of any loyalty to him, because I don't have any loyalty to him. He's a Texas A&M guy. I'm not a Texas A&M fan. He's a former Browns quarterback, not a current one. So I have no loyalty there. But what I hope is just from a human standpoint, what I had hoped to hear was instead of I have a killer gym and I can work out in it, I have good friends supporting in what I do and I support them in what they do, and I'm interested in football as well as a whole bunch of other things, but I got to see what the future holds. I was really hoping to hear a kid start to put his life together and say, I've been sober now for 17 days. I started on July 1st, 17 days. It's a process, and I'm going to remain sober if it's humanly possible. I have a bunch of friends supporting me in my sobriety. I'm spending my time being fully healthy, not partly healthy. I'm spending my time at my killer gym working the heck out and trying to achieve my dream of being a starting quarterback in the National Football League. But I don't think this kid even has a hint of the dedication it will take to A, remain sober, and B, play his way back into even a tryout with the National Football League team.
Reading between the lines,
he's done.
Yeah, I do too, Bob. And reading between the lines and some of the on some of those comments in his statement, I almost get the impression that this is a guy who thinks he could still have somebody call him up tomorrow and offer him some kind of job in the league as a quarterback again. I don't think he realizes it. I don't think that phone call's coming at all.
No, I think he's completely done. I really do. I don't know if I agree with you on what you think he's thinking right now. I think he knows it's over. I think he knows it's over. I don't think he thinks there's a call coming or that it can come. I think he knows it's over. That's why he is like kind of tamping down expectations. Oh, I got a lot of opportunities. I'm exploring my options to see what the future holds. I'm interested in a lot of things. Right now, I'm just being healthy. I'm not saying I'm never going to drink again. Look, Jim, if he ever thought he was going to get signed by another football team or even given a tryout again, he would be telling every football team that would listen, I am sober. I am not drinking anymore. I'm done with that part of my reckless life. But he's sitting here saying, I'm not saying I'm not going to drink again. And I'm not saying I'm making all the right decisions. I've got a lot of friends who support what I do. Not what I am trying to do, what I do. And we know what he does. He parties. And he's a 23-year-old frat boy who has never gotten out of, you know, age 18 in his freshman year at college. That's what he is. I think he knows no call is coming, and I think he's okay with that. And I think he's trying to kind of tamp down everybody else's expectations so that they're okay with that. Am I thinking about football? Yeah, sure. But I'm also thinking about a lot of other things, too, just exploring my options. That's code for I'm not putting in the work that it takes to try to get back to the show. And then when I don't get back to the show, have to acknowledge that I failed. He never wants to have to acknowledge that he failed. And that's why he's saying, yeah, I'm looking at what all my options are. Now, when he doesn't go back to the league because he has no ability or interest to do so, his response to the world who criticizes him is, I had better options. I think he knows he's done. And I don't think he'll ever come near an NFL training camp again. Mark that down. All right, 3:57 now. Coming up on 3:58, we're going to get a timeout. We're going to come back and talk football more from the Lions side of things. Chris Lemieux, our good friend from PrideOfDetroit.com, got some Lions stories for us. We'll find out what he thinks about the Lions celebrating and commemorating that tremendous season in which they didn't lose their last game until much later than other times, which is called a playoff loss, and they are celebrating as a phenomenal accomplishment. It is not sitting well with a lot of Lions fans. We'll see what Chris Lemieux thinks about that and much more. We want to get your phone calls as well. What do you think about the NFL's new goalpost idea? Is it a good idea to encourage more going for it on fourth down by narrowing the post to lower the chances at field goals going in? And we'll get into that and a whole lot more as we continue. ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Well, now Chris Jimenez gets his first at-bat of the day after Yan Gomes left. And there's a line drive base hit left field. That'll score Naquin. Here comes Almonte. And Chris Jimenez steps in and delivers a two-out, two-run single to make it a 4-0 Indians lead. Clobbered to deep center. Back is Santana. He's going to watch this one leave the yard. Tyler Naquin with his 10th home run of the year. He went down and golfed that baby to straightaway center field. And it's a 5-1 Indians lead.
It's a shoulder injury. We're going to get him back to Cleveland, get him scanned tomorrow, and we'll have more information. But until we get him looked at, just a shoulder injury. We're obviously going to be out.
Should have gotten a live chicken.
Ventura sets the 1-1 in the dirt. Gets away from Perez all the way back to the screen. Castellanos in. We're tied at 2. Escobar shades up the middle. The 1-0. Swinging a fly ball right field. Way back and right in. Gone. An absolute no doubter off the bat of Soltalamacchia.
World number one making a Sunday move.
Well, she's not only world number one, she's the best putter on the LPGA Tour and taking full advantage of that strength.
There it is. At long last, her 14th win on the LPGA Tour. And it was indeed a marathon conclusion.
It's a tough green, and you know, with the green firming up and the wind slightly, you know, helping, it needed to be, you know, some kind of shot that you could spin. And, you know, it was like deja vu the second time, you know, almost similar putts.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And the extravaganza does indeed roll on right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks so much for spending the time with us a little bit this afternoon. A lot of good stuff there in the montage by Jim Cushlin. Indians winners 2 out of 3 over the weekend. Tigers winners 2 out of 3 over the weekend. So the 6.5 game lead by the Indians. The Tigers deficit remains the same. You just heard Lydia Ko winning the 2016 Marathon Classic. We had a great time out there on Thursday and Friday.
It was the second time it went to a playoff. Well, they had to play 4 of them before it got decided.
That's why they call it a marathon.
Absolutely.
Right? A marathon classic. That is exactly
the
right.
The puns worked on Sunday. That is true.
Indeed they did. And thanks again to Jim Heller and Jim Decker and everyone, Judd Silverman, everybody who was responsible for the great event and who had us out there on Thursday and Friday. And of course, Mike Miller was there all week long. So another great successful event up there at Highland Meadows and the Marathon Classic. Hour number 2 is underway now at 4:10. Forgive me in advance for doing this to you, but I kind of felt like I really have to do this to you / for you. When I see the headline, or I'm sorry, one of the headlines about the Roger Goodell story that I was talking about before with HBO's Ballers, Mark Wahlberg, formerly known as Marky Mark Wahlberg, alleging that Roger Goodell called him to try to stop the production of this show because he doesn't want to make the NFL look bad. The first line in the New York Daily News coverage of this from today, quote, there might be some bad vibrations between the NFL and Mark Wahlberg. There might be some bad vibrations. I have no choice here. Understand that. This is not by choice. They made it happen. Marky Mark. Circa 1990-something. Mark Wahlberg. Back when he was still doing Calvin Klein underwear commercials, by the way. Was also somewhat kind of sort of white boy rapping about good vibration. We call this white boy rap? Is this rap? Mark Wahlberg. bad vibrations with the NFL. In a radio appearance on ESPN's Mike and Mike, Wahlberg said he received complaints from the NFL all throughout season one of Ballers. The NFL denies it, says it never happened. Hence the bad vibrations. The 45-year-old actor revealed to Mike and Mike that it was hard to get players to appear on the show. He said if he wanted the show to portray the real story of what goes on off the field in the NFL, and that, quote, the first season of the show, the only calls I was getting were from guys like Roger Goodell saying, you can't do this. And various owners in the league, we were saying it's actually a good thing for the league and the players because hopefully you'll get the word out there with the crazy stuff. You feel it, baby? And then, no, he didn't say you'll feel it, baby, to the New York Daily News or Mike and Mike. But he wants to know if you feel it, baby, to get the financial side of it out there. And hopefully these guys will realize they've got to be more careful with what they do with their money. That was Marky Mark's take on the whole thing. The NFL, not so much. Put the crack up! When did this come out anyway, Kushley? Do you remember this?
Yes, I do. Yeah, it's 90, 91, no later than 92.
You got to get a lot louder if you're going to be heard over the Funky Bunch, baby.
It was either 90, 91, or 92.
Donnie D's on the backup. Drug-free, so put that crack up, all right? You understand? You know what's funny as you look back at this now? I mean, Mark Wahlberg has become a pretty doggone good... a pretty doggone good actor, well-respected. I mean, remember, he played the... what was the... I bet Chris Lemieux knows. Bring Lemieux on. We're going to talk to Chris Lemieux at PrideDetroit.com anyway. I bet he remembers. What was the movie about the Philadelphia Eagles walk-on player who came on during a strike? I think it was during a strike. And Vince Papale was his name. The movie came out just, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago. Do you remember this, Chris Lemieux? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Am I on right now?
Yeah, you're on. I just said
I'm hearing this. Good vibrations.
Yeah, all right, good vibrations.
I'm feeling it. It's funny that these two have decided to clash. Like, it's like, if you ever wanted to know what the clash would be of a guy used to be like a cocaine addict who's pled guilty to assault and was charged with attempted murder, has somehow turned his career around into like international blockbuster movie star, like versus Roger Goodell, and then I'm like, yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards the former rather than Roger Goodell on who to believe.
I think so. Roger Goodell has proven himself to be a liar many, many, many times over. Marky Wahlberg, not as much. although Goodell, I don't know if he's ever done anything quite as embarrassing as Good Vibrations.
I don't know. I wish I could help you with the movie thing. I am notoriously, though, bad at, like, I have not seen a lot of sports movies. I think the only sports-related movies I've seen was, like, Mighty Duck and Sandlot.
Invincible. Invincible. I think that's the title you're looking for.
That's it. Yeah.
And by the way, does this song ever end? How long is this tune?
It's like four or five minutes.
Dude, still playing it for a good, like, yeah.
See, I guess when you're drug-free, you got stamina. You know, when you're drug-free and you put the crack up, you've got stamina. When you got Donnie D on the backup and the Funky Bunch just kicking, you can go for a while. There it is. You can go for 4 minutes and 20 seconds of song. You know the worst part about this? You know, both you guys, Kush and Chris, the worst part about this, seriously, is anybody that's like over 30 or 35 who remembers this song from the 90s, is secretly digging this right now. They're kicking it. They're loving this.
Man, I'm not even 30, and I'm still kind of just dancing a little bit. It's an old blast there, I got to say. You know, it's a side of Mark Wahlberg I did not, like, you know, that's been fairly well buried to time. I've got to say, props to the retro.
By the way, I got to just acknowledge something here. Now I realize why the song seems so damn long. It started over. It was on repeat.
There you go.
It wasn't supposed to be on loop. I'm gonna admit something right now that is going to destroy any credibility I might ever have with men my age, guys in their 40s who are devoted to classic rock, which I am, by the way, to classic rock and 80s music, which I am, by the way. Remember, I'm a child of the 80s. I went to high school in the 80s. I went to college in the 80s. 82 through 90, those are my, I'm sorry, 82 through 86. Yeah, those are my high school and college years. So I'm a child of that era. So 80s, 70s, and 60s kind of is my thing. 90s, not so much. But I'm gonna destroy my own cred here when I tell you. The reason it was easier for me to pull that song up was because it's actually on my iPhone. It's on my
wonderful
playlist. It is on my playlist. I kid you not, and I am embarrassed by that. I am humiliated by that. I cannot ever live that down. But it's there.
I mean, it's
that's the reason, Chris, why I know that as I played it. Any guys listening, and we obviously have a very male-dominated audience here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Any guy that was listening to it who's over 30 or 35 is probably doing the same damn thing and going, this is terrible, it's awful, but let it play. Keep it going. Because they
kind of... It's funny
or maybe
it's
not.
It's funny because I'm 29. I'm probably the last person I know to have, like, an iPod. The idea of, you say it's on the phone, like, you know, everyone these days, it's Spotify and it's Pandora. I don't even think people have, like, the accessible playlist anymore.
I do, and I'm like you. I started out with the iPod, but I have an iPhone now. And the truth of the matter is I'm too cheap to buy Spotify and pay $10 a month for it, you know?
I have my iPod because I used to run, like, a music radio show when I was in, like, college. Like, oh, yeah? So I just have everything on there for the aux cable. Yeah,
well, that makes sense. That makes sense. And for me, you know, the other thing is, too, is I have a CD collection that fills, like, four of those giant CD sleeve books.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you can take your CDs, pop them in your computer, and then put them on your iPhone.
Man.
So, you know, this way they're not going to waste. This way they're not just the CD generation lives on.
I got, like, a new MacBook. I don't even think it has a CD drive on it.
It probably doesn't. It probably doesn't, but my HP does, and that's how I was able to get a lot of this stuff on there. But I got a very eclectic playlist on my iPhone, on my music portion of my phone. But anyway, so there you go. The movie was Vince Papale, about Vince Papale, was Invincible. He was the walk-on who came on during a strike, I guess it was, and it's just really – it was a really great story. And Mark Wahlberg has gone on to be a pretty doggone well-respected actor in a number of films, not including Ted, by the way, which is just about as silly and goofy as Good Vibrations was. But you look back and
I wouldn't call Transformers respected, but okay.
I didn't see Transformers, so I can't. I didn't know.
Yeah, he took over for, like, Shia LaBeouf or however you say that name. I'm terrible at pronouncing.
I don't
names.
Say that name, so I I really have no idea. Hold on, just because we're doing it. Hold on a second.
Okay.
I want to go ahead and throw this up here. A little filmography of Mr. Wahlberg, because he, like I said, he has actually had a pretty good career since his Marky Mark days.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I remember. What was it? That final scene with him in The Departed. That was fantastic. Like he's played the same kind of just very chunky Boston guy ever since, like, all around. And yeah, The Departed. He had a kind of secondary role in that.
Yeah,
so he had
that was one of the best scenes
in that movie.
That was one
the
of his best
scene.
Roles. Oh, Boogie Nights, Dirk Diggler, for crying out loud. Boogie Nights. He was Dirk Diggler. Marky Mark was Dirk Diggler, and he was less embarrassing as Dirk Diggler than he was as Marky Mark. With the you know what he was? I mean, John Cena was built on Marky Mark, I think. If you think about Marky Mark in the Calvin Klein commercials, it was where, like, you know, the first white guy sagged their pants so that you could see the top of the, you know, the waistband.
John Cena.
I mean, he was John Cena before John Cena became a much larger version of Marky Mark. Planet of the Apes, of course, he was in the remake of that. The Truth About Charlie. The Italian Job, that was
Three Kings.
One. The Departed, as you mentioned. What was that?
He was in Three Kings with Ice Cube.
Yes, he was.
Spike Jones.
That's a good one, too. Did you know, by the way, he was also considered for one of the roles in Brokeback Mountain? Yeah.
It was supposed I could see to be, it. I guess I could see it. But
it was supposed
accent,
to be,
like,
Mark Wahlberg and Joaquin Phoenix instead of Heath Ledger and... what's dude?
I don't remember.
You know the other guy.
This is like, yeah, no. Just,
yes, you do.
I didn't see that.
Jake Gyllenhaal. Jake Gyllenhaal.
Jake Gyllenhaal. There you go. Oh, yeah.
So
lovely
so
man of the internet. Yes.
He was also in M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, and I'm in my We Own the Night. I mean, he's had a very good career anyway. So it was just kind of he probably gets killed every. Oh, you know what's another guilty pleasure movie? And I know we're totally off on a tangent here, but sometimes that happens on sports radio. It just becomes guy talk radio. But did you ever see Rockstar with him and Jennifer Aniston?
I did not see Rockstar.
You know what it's about?
Yeah, no, I know the film. I know that film. That was, what, 01?
I don't know.
Yeah, it was. Really? Yeah, it's that old. It's 15 years. Congratulations.
I didn't realize that. You know we're talking about Rockstar, the TV show, or the movie Rockstar?
Yeah, I vaguely remember.
Oh, no, I remember this movie now. I remember this movie now that as soon as I saw the poster, I looked it up here. I remember this because this was actually, like, kind of a based on a true story thing because it was about and I should know this because I was way into metal when I was younger. This was about Tim Owens, the guy who took over, the lead singer who took over for Judas Priest, the guy who kind of like was this fan in like a bunch of Judas Priest tribute bands, and like he became the lead singer of Judas Priest.
I did not know that. I didn't know that was based on a true story. I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, Tim the Ripper Owens.
Yeah.
When Rob Halford retired out of Judas Priest, it was kind of like, they said, oh, hey, look, there's this fan who's done all these tribute bands, but he sounds excellent. Well, let's go get him.
That's really, really an interesting story. That is a guilty pleasure movie. And you never saw it? You were into metal and you knew the whole Judas Priest story, but you didn't go see that movie? You're kidding?
No,
Classic once in a while?
I have... You say you have eclectic taste in music. My taste in movies, like, I only really get out to see a couple movies each year, and then everything else I have is just really old, weird. It's just really old, weird, like old westerns and like sci-fi things. Like, my idea is like trying to find like Zardoz or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas or something. And watching those, just like the really weird movies
out there. Hold on, since you brought them up. Here we go.
Oh, no.
I got to tell you, this might be the only Judas Priest song I really know. As soon as you said Judas Priest, that was the one that I pulled up because it's the only one that I know. But
Not Another Thing Coming?
What's that? Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Good one.
Yeah,
good one, but I forgot about that.
Painkiller? Yeah. No, I could probably name more than I care to remember, to be honest.
I'm actually looking at the video of them doing this. This is the actual video. And I got to tell you, nothing makes this song better than the leather wristbands that go from wrist to elbow with the silver studs. The silver studded leather wristbands and the skin-tight bodysuit. The skin-tight bodysuit that Tim Owens, is that who it is? Or no, that's the guy who filled
in. That would have been Rob Halford, because Rob Halford eventually came out as gay. Yeah, that was the Rob Halford look. That kind of inspired a whole generation of the LGBT culture right there.
Skin-tight bodysuit, it's a leotard essentially, but a tank top, one-piece leotard, separated by a checkerboard-looking weight belt. Like a weightlifting.
I know that looked pretty well. I lived in Vancouver. I lived near, what's that village called? I don't remember. I lived pretty near where the gay community was. I know that looked pretty well.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't know if it's necessarily specific to the gay community, because I know Cushion has this outfit. His wife once sent me a pic, you know, when they went out to dinner. But, you know, hey, that's okay, like I said, because it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter what your taste is. But all I know is that Judas Priest rocked it. And this dude, who is it, Rob Halford?
Rob Halford, yeah, the original.
Yeah. Dude living it after midnight. All right, we've gone so many different directions than what we brought you on to talk about, Chris Lemieux.
Sure.
So maybe we ought to get down to talking about Detroit sports, since you do, after all, work right for prideofdetroit.com. Anyway, the point about that movie, for those who don't know what I'm talking about, I call it a guilty pleasure. It's one of those ones where if I'm flipping around my DirecTV on a given day or night, and there's nothing to watch, and I'm just kind of checking through the guide, channel guide, and I see that, I stop on it. It's one of those ones that I watch. First of all, Jennifer Aniston, incredibly hot, absolutely smoking hot in that particular movie. She is just amazing. Second of all, the scenes are just really, really, amazing. You know, it's exactly what you said about the real story with Judas Priest. This tribute band singer just is, obsessed with this band, and he ends up becoming their lead singer. He replaces the lead singer after they basically have a parting of ways with the rest of the band. And it's a little cheesy. It's a little goofy. It's a little, you know, I don't even think it was that highly rated. It's probably doesn't have more than a 40% score on Rotten Tomatoes. But it's just kind of fun, and it's kind of cool, and she is smoking hot. So since you brought it up, Chris, that you knew the backstory, or not the backstory, the inspiration story with Tim Owens, you should definitely pick that one up. Watch that one.
But yeah, I'll go through it. It's on my backlog.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one. All right, now, having finished all of that nonsense up, let's talk a little bit about Pride of Detroit. Can you say definitively, Mr. Chris Lemieux, with prideofdetroit.com, which is official SB Nation site, can you say with definitive proof that there is any pride in Detroit when it comes to the Lions, and you know that they're going to have a commemoration of a 1991 football season that ended in a playoff loss after one playoff win, the only one they've had in 20 or 25 years? They're celebrating not a championship, not a Super Bowl appearance, but a season that ended with a loss like all of the other ones have, but this loss happened a little bit later in December than the other ones normally do. So therefore, we're going to have a commemoration. We're going to hang banners about playoff appearances. Is that really what we need to be doing?
Well, they're not hanging a banner, and to be clear, like, they do this for a 25-year anniversary for every team. It just happens. This is the 91 team, thus, you know, everyone gets to write the articles about, like, hey, look, the Lions are celebrating their one playoff win. And, like, yeah, no, like, if you ask a Lion fan, you can get one of two different reactions. You probably could anything else. I don't understand why this has become a big story.
What's the banner part of this, though? Hold on a second, Chris, because, Kush, you mentioned something about a banner. What did I miss on that?
Well, it's not so much a banner, though I can attest, 2 years ago, there are two banners in Ford Field. I was calling a state championship game for Michigan High School football a couple of Novembers ago, and I distinctly remember being in Ford Field, and there was two banners listing the years that they actually made the playoffs. I do remember that.
Yeah,
does exist.
Yeah. Well,
okay,
I mean, they've got
so they're basically hanging like you know, championship teams hang championship banners from the rafters. They're hanging, hey, we made the playoffs. We made the playoffs. So did seven other teams, by the way, or six other teams or whatever it is, but we made the playoffs. Go ahead.
I mean, I could probably ape off what my friend Kent was writing. Like, you know, the New England Patriots, they hung a banner for the perfect season that ended in a loss. The Colts had that remarkable AFC finalist banner that they put up. New Orleans Saints, they had a banner up for an attendance record at one point. So, I mean, it's not unique. It's just because this is the Lions, it just makes for a very easy target. I mean, look,
yeah,
like, as
on,
I said.
But hold on. But here's the thing. The Colts have won a Super Bowl. The Patriots have won multiple Super Bowls, and the Saints have won a Super Bowl, so they can be forgiven a little bit. For a team that hasn't won one, though, it looks a little desperate. This is all we've got. Not in addition
sure,
to our championship banners, this is all we got.
Sure, and at the time, probably that looked desperate for the Saints, but I mean, like, that's an always a weird one. So, like, what are we, is like everyone supposed to wallow in misery until they've won one, and then all of a sudden everything's back on the table? I don't really get that. Like, that's a very unique thing to football too, because, like, if you're a loser in baseball, we will celebrate you. We'll celebrate the Cubs, even though they've stunk dramatically for over 100 years. And if you're a loser in basketball, we'll just completely ignore you like we do the Sacramento Kings. But we don't really.
Well, wait a minute.
Like,
wait, for some reason,
a moral panic in football for some reason, even though this
well,
is like
on.
A
let's
sport
discuss
that. Most...
Let's discuss that for a second about celebrating. Who celebrates the Cubs? I mean, the Cubs aren't celebrated for not having won
a championship
since
1908.
They're just, you know, I mean, they're made fun of, in fact, for having selling out Wrigley every single year, and that's why people say ownership has no incentive to spend the money to build a championship team, because the stupid Cubs fans go out there and sell out every single game, so they don't have any reason to. They're not hurting for money. I mean, I don't know anybody who's celebrated their non-championship.
We hype up the Cubs nonstop. Like, we do a lot of stuff for the Cubs. I don't know, man. It just feels like in football, it's more of a moral panic about a loser trying not to be, like, portrayed as so much a loser. Like, I've seen so many just different takes on this thing, and it's like there's people out there saying, like, they shouldn't celebrate this, and I just don't know, like, why should they not celebrate this? It's like the one. Okay, on the side that they are, that yes, it is their only playoff win ever since the AFL-NFL merger. Like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of something nice. But I guess my question is like, what does this harm by celebrating it, other than like the two parties, one party who believes that any form, like, who sees this as the extension of the participation trophy, and those people are some of the most bewildering sports fans I have ever seen in my life. And the other part are probably the weirder people who think this is somehow going to impact Matthew Stafford. Like, the idea is, like, he's throwing a football, and he's like, oh, wait, I was really thinking about the 91 team, and now, oh, now I've thrown an interception. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, so, like, what's the harm in seeing these guys?
I don't know any of those people that you just described on the back end with the
I've
whole
seen weird lines. Yeah.
But
yeah,
the bewildering ones, you described the bewildering people who see it as an extension of the participation trophy. My hand is in the air. Guilty. That is exactly
well,
how
let
I
me,
see
let
it.
Let me say this.
We
as
participated.
Someone who did,
hold on, Chris. We participated in the playoffs and didn't lose the first playoff game. It's the only time that has happened in 25 years, or and so therefore it is worth celebrating. We didn't lose our first playoff game that year. We lost our second playoff game. That sounds like an extension of participation trophy to me. I mean, to the latter. I mean, you didn't even get out of the NFC. You didn't get to the Super Bowl to have that loss. You really could say, hey, we were at least NFC champions. That is something you hang a banner for. That is something you hold a 1991 team commemoration. Remember the NFC Championship team of 1991, not the team that was held to, you know, what, 200 yards of total offense, or 240 yards of total offense or something, in a loss in which you were routed 41-10 for an opportunity to go to a Super Bowl. You know, that you're, if you're celebrating that and bringing all the guys back, you are saying we participated. Where is the juice boxes?
Look, as someone who's gotten participation trophies, it doesn't make you feel any better. Like, I know this is like the favorite thing for like people to really rail about, but like, you still remember that you lost that. So I don't really know like what the harm is really in it. It's an attempt to just soften an otherwise horrific blow to someone's psyche, especially for kids, for like their just already fragile psyche trying to figure out everything else that is like. But to keep it again to the professional side of things here too, it's just, I guess my counter argument is like that 91 team was also really fun. Like, you go through some of those names, I still see a lot of those names up in like people wearing their, like, let's see here, Brett Perriman, Herman Moore, Barry Sanders, like Chris Spielman was on that team. Like, these are names I see on Eric Kramer. These are names I see on jerseys when I go up to Ford Field. People still love a lot of the guys that were on that. So, like, yeah, like, there's definitely a market for people who have fond memories of the team.
But Chris, then you know what you do? Then you have a, hey, come on out this Sunday, or come on out Sunday, October 27th, or whatever day it is. I have no idea. It doesn't matter. Come on out for Lions Alumni Day. Some of your favorite names from Lions teams in the past. Barry Sanders, Eric Kramer, Chris Spielman. You know, all these guys are going to be there. That's fantastic. But don't celebrate a team that really didn't give you anything to celebrate beyond.
That's what they're doing, Bob.
We didn't lose our first playoff game.
It's the 25th anniversary every year for every team. Like, just because this happens to fall the 25th anniversary of 91, it's suddenly a moral panic. Again, they do this every year with every alumni team on their 25th anniversary. Last year was the celebration
of
the
1990
team.
It's more of just a marketing ploy then, basically. It's more maybe they can sell some tickets by bringing guys back every year to do one of these.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Like, a lot of teams do. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, but again, because it makes for a very easy headline, because it is on the anniversary of the 91 team, then that's what we pick up with, and we kind of focus on that, and everyone gets out the pitchforks, and away we go, and here we are. And, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't want to view sports through the lens of, like, just if you won, then that's the only thing that did. How many 30 for 30s have we done on the losers? Like, before we amended Believeland, how about the ones where we did four Super Bowl losses for the Buffalo Bills?
Oh, like, yeah, the four falls of Buffalo. That was a good one.
Yeah, that was a really good one. But, like, we find ways to celebrate guys who don't always make it to the finish line. And it's always funny to me that it's like the Lions are the one who's the punching bag and not, say, the Colts,
Chris, you know what you're doing? You are standing up and proudly exhibiting the name of the website. You are exhibiting pride of Detroit. You're taking this personally.
Which is funny,
like,
because
they're the only ones who are the quote unquote punching bags. And that's not true. I promise you, any other cities that do this, you know, might not be on a national, and this really isn't on a national scale either. This is on Detroit, in Detroit media, or in our case, Northwest Ohio, close enough to Detroit media, et cetera. This is about
this is about, you know, a local, like, whoa, really? Is this what we're celebrating because we, you know, we won our one playoff game? If this was going on in other cities, I promise you they would be just as quote-unquote punchy-baggy. I mean, talking about a team that hasn't done anything for so long, they would be just as punch-baggy, if you will, as the Lions are here. I don't think this is exclusive.
I will cede that point, but I will object to, again, being called a fan because most of the people who, like, comment on Pride of Detroit apparently don't think I'm a Lions fan. So
why do they
just,
think that?
What?
Why do they not think that?
I don't know. It's one of the running gags. It's happened since I came on board. I think I wrote something about Matthew Stafford. It's been one of the running gags we've had. So
you wrote something critical, and they figured, oh, if you criticize, therefore you're not a fan.
Yeah, or something. I don't know. And you know what? I don't really aspire to be in this class of fan writer that we seem to really be cherishing a lot of the times, too. I'd rather think I can be a little more clear-eyed about it. And, like, yeah, no, there's probably some more punchy bags out there. Like, again, like, I always find it funny that we don't do too much with the Colts, even though their owner is a dope fiend and the son of an alcoholic crazy person. But, you know, hey, they get two of the two generational talents at quarterback, and they fall into that.
Yeah, yeah, they really did.
If I could play devil's
advocate, go ahead.
Yeah, let's just play a quick devil's advocate on this. I think part of the reason, obviously, is because it's a little more local, is commemorating, and you're right, it has been 25 years, so those kind of numbers usually make them do things like this. But I think it really brings back to the forefront, quite frankly, how for decades overall pitiful this franchise has been. I mean, that 91 sure. is the only time they've won a playoff game since the 50. You said the merger. It's actually since 1957 when they won an NFL title against the Browns.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. So this back a while.
It just makes it that much more stark that, wow.
Sure.
Because what it really means is the 1991 Detroit Lions are the best Detroit Lions team in the last 50 years. And so on all sides are going to come out of the woodwork because of that.
Sure, sure. And I guess my argument would be, like, again, like, just like we were talking about with me getting a participation trophy when I was a kid, no one is going to, like, instantly forget how bad the Lions are just because they're celebrating the 91 team. Like, everyone's quite aware of it, and they will continue to be quite aware of it for a very long time. And they'll, again, continue to celebrate. And, like, a lot of people out there, both in the national media, too, will continue to, I mean, like, have their fun headlines, like Pro Football Talk does every time the Lions do something. It's always a joke on the Lions' expense, which, I mean, yeah, sure, they probably deserve it at this point, but that's how it goes.
Oh, there's no probably about it. I mean, they do. I mean, you know, this doesn't happen by accident. You don't accident your way. It's like the Cleveland thing, the 52 years without a title in any of the main sports. You know, it wasn't an accident. I mean, yeah, they had some bad luck with the fumble, and they had some, you know, well, not bad luck. You just great opponents like John Elway guiding that 98-yard drive, for crying out loud. You know, there are things that just happen. But by and large, if you don't win a championship in any of your sports for 52 years, you know, it's legit. You suck. You know, your franchises just have not been putting enough talent together to do something, and you deserve all of the ridicule that comes with it. I have never
right, but I guess my question would be then again,
going, I think the Lions have to wear that too.
Sure, sure. And I guess my big question would, again, keep going back to the Cubs, is like, the Cubs have lovable loser as the name, and it's like, okay, they get to be lovable, but the Lions aren't lovable. They just stink. I'm trying to figure out where that disconnect comes. Is it because of Chicago? Is it because baseball versus football?
I think you're personalizing it too much, because the Cubs are the only team, and now correct me if I'm wrong here. I don't think I am, though. I don't know that I've ever heard of anybody else referred to as the lovable losers other than the Cubbies. You know, the little Cubbies
sure.
who always try but can't quite get over the hill. Everybody else that's a loser is just a loser, and they're made fun of as losers. The Clippers were the joke of the NBA for 25 years before they finally got good in the last few years. And, of course, Donald Sterling was forced to sell the team. We know the whole drill. But they were just made fun of. I mean, they were the joke. The Lakers were La La Land and Showtime, and the Clippers were just the ugly stepsister that, God, you guys should fold your franchise. Losing teams for decades and decades are always made fun of, with the exception of the Cubs.
Sure.
They're the only one, I think, sure. unless you guys can think of another one.
No, I can't think of another one. The Cubs are the only one that I can think of that's referred to that way.
I mean, I see people stand for the Sacramento Kings, but that's maybe a little something different. I don't know. Maybe that's just a Sacramento thing.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know anything about, you know, what goes on up there, but I just know that the Cubby thing, like I said, You know, for again, from the Cleveland standpoint of being losers, nobody called him lovable. Nobody had lovable losers attached to the Browns who haven't won since the Super Bowl began, the Super Bowl era began. Nobody's looking back.
Yeah, but they get the 30 for 30.
Well, they got that because of 52 years of celebrating, not celebrating, I should say, but wallowing in their own near misses. You know, all of those opportunities.
I don't think they get that because of the
World Series, they blew it. The 95 World Series, they blew it. The drive, they blew it. The shot, Jordan broke their hearts. All of that stuff didn't say, you guys are still awesome. It says, man, this is the pain you guys live with.
Yeah, I guess. I don't believe that sports should be about wallowing in misery. Like, I don't believe this is a morality play that somehow if you're a miserable sports fan for X number of years that the heavens will open and you'll be rewarded with, like, I don't know, a trophy or something. That, to me, is more offensive than a participation trophy.
No, I don't know. I think I can see it, to be honest. I mean, there is a reason why, for how many decades, Wide World of Sports on ABC opened with the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. That skier who broke his neck, his ribs, his fibula, his tibia, his femur, and virtually every other bone in his body going down that hill all of those times. That's what sport is. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat, and wallowing in misery and near misses is what sport is all about.
That's a personal defeat. Like, the fans did nothing to do that other than the claim that they were cheering. Like, the fans don't have any personal skin in that game on that defeat. Whereas, like, when you're talking about that skier, that's his personal defeat.
Yeah,
so,
but,
we're getting into some philosophical questions, but
that was just an example of the thrill of victory and agony of defeat. But when you talk about team sports, teams representing cities. Fans do have skin in the game, and it's called their heart. You know, it's called their heart. There's a reason why tears flow down cheeks for the losing team. There's a reason why that kid at the Michigan game, he became a meme. He became a viral sensation with his hands on his cheeks and his mouth wide open after the drop punt snap and Michigan State's victory. There's a reason why that happens, because you do have your skin in the game is your heart, your emotions, and fans wear them on their sleeves when they lose. And when you lose for that many years in a row, it becomes I don't want to say a badge of honor, a badge of courage, or whatever you want to call it. But if you're just kind of a middle of the road, we win a little bit, we lose a little bit, we always come close to titles, but we don't get them. It's different than decades of suckitude versus decades of greatness. Those fans kind of have special types of, I don't know, they have special, the market cornered on emotions of victory and of defeat.
I guess. I mean, maybe this is why they don't call me a fan, because I just don't see any point to that for myself, and I don't really wear a loss on my sleeve. Like, I mean, Lions lose, and I'm like, okay, 5 minutes later, I'm good. So
that's because you're so used
maybe
to
that's
them.
It.
That's because you're so used to it. Now let them go to the NFC playoffs 2 or 3 years in a row. Let them go and make it to the NFC Championship game a couple of times and lose on a heartbreaking finish, a la Believeland, with what happened, with the
Hummer. I mean,
let that happen and see if you don't start to wear those a little bit more on your sleeve than just, it's another loss,
because
it's another not even close to being a playoff team.
But I don't wear those Tigers loss on my sleeve either, or the Pistons loss, or the Notre Dame losses, or any of the other teams I follow. So,
okay.
I guess maybe I'm the rare breed.
Then maybe you are. Maybe you are, because that's what most fans do, obviously. Hey, real quick before you go, Arian Foster going to work out. Any thoughts? Can he help at all?
He signed to the Dolphins as we were speaking, actually.
Oh, did he really?
Okay. Yeah. He was working out with them on Monday. He didn't even make it to Detroit, apparently.
Okay.
So that's said and done. But, hey, before I go, just want to shout out to Javid Best. He's a former Lion. He is qualified now for the Rio Olympics, which are still going on, shockingly. But, he had to retire from football, and he's going to be representing – his father's country. Let me just make sure I have this right. Yeah, his father's country of his father's dual citizenship with St. Lucia. I believe that's one of the U.S. Virgin Islands, or is that a?
I don't know. That is a good question. That is a good question.
No, it's his own country.
It's
his own country.
I saw the story too that he was qualifying. Yeah. But I don't know the details of it. But congratulations to him. That's very, very cool.
Yeah. That'll be something that'll be brought up, I'm sure, on these Olympic broadcasts coming soon.
On the way out the door, Mr. Lemieux, how about another verse just like the other verse? Let's go and give it to you. Feel it, my friend.
Oh, no.
Feel those vibrations. Marky Mark. Marky Mark Lemieux. Chris Lemieux, ProudlyDetroit.com, wearing that pride proudly today, without question.
I guess.
In defense of his Lions and their 1991 near, kind of, sort of, almost made it to the Super Bowl maybe.
You keep calling me this, I'm going to get in trouble.
Take care, man. We appreciate it.
All right, take care.
4:47 now. The extravaganza continues. We'll get a quick timeout here for SportsCenter. Come back and wrap this bad boy up on ESPN 106.5. You feel it, baby? The ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, final segment of the broadcast this afternoon. Thanks to Crystal Mee, really a lot of fun there talking about Detroit. And by the way, we were looking up the year that the Good Vibration song was recorded. I don't know if it's just coincidence. I guess it is, or maybe it is fate or something even deeper than that. But that song was released in July of 1991, the very same year of the Lions' last playoff victory, 25 years ago this year. In fact, 25 years ago this month, right now, it might have been released on the 18th.
For all we know.
You talk about kismet, Kushlin. I don't know what it is.
That's pretty funny. And we were debating, you and I, off air before you found that. It's like, yeah, I kept saying, I know it's somewhere between 90, 91, and definitely no later than 92, but I honestly couldn't remember. I knew it was in that ballpark.
I called 92. That was my pick, and I was a little off. It was July of 1991, but I just thought that was hilarious. That it was the exact same time as we kicked through some of those things. So anyway, the whole purpose of all that, if you did not know why we were reminiscing about Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch from 1991, Mark Wahlberg, of course, is the executive producer of the Ballers series on HBO that Roger Goodell in the NFL is said not to like. Goodell denies that he called Wahlberg and said, don't do this show because it's going to make us look bad and make the league look bad, which is supposed to be a realistic portrayal of how the Ballers waste their money. And just rip through their money as professional. You know, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, plays the role of the agent, if you will, who's trying to financially counsel these guys on how not to blow their millions and millions and millions of dollars and end up broke by the age of 30. It's got a whole bunch of cameos by a whole bunch of NFL players, and Roger Goodell is said to not like it. So he denied the report that he tried to get this thing stopped. But I agree with Chris Lemieux. I'm going to go ahead and side against Roger Goodell whenever he speaks because he's a born liar, but also because, quite frankly, we have seen the NFL back in 2003, we talked about this in the first hour, do this to the ESPN production playmakers, which was controversial for a bunch of different reasons, but it covered a lot of the different issues that we've seen socially in the National Football League in the last 13 years, and obviously leading up to that. Steroids, players wasting money, womanizing in the locker room, gay players, closeted gay players back then, getting busted by their teammates, and then, of course, all of the discomfort created in the locker room and all that stuff going on. ESPN had a hit on their hands. It only lasted, I don't think it lasted a season. I don't think it lasted the full season. I want to say they got into maybe like episode 9 or 10 or something like that, and they just pulled the plug. Oh, that's it. Done. No more. It didn't even finish its first season, if I'm not mistaken, because the NFL had it shut down. It was a really, really kind of a gritty show, and people loved it. It was a hit, and it was going to go for a while. I promise you it would have. It had some award nominations, as a matter of fact, but the NFL basically strong-armed ESPN into shutting it down. So, yeah, you better believe. And I don't know if people watch Ballers or not. I haven't. I didn't watch the first season. I'm more interested in it now because of the story. So congratulations, Roger Goodell. You may have just created myself and a whole bunch of other new fans for a show that you don't want people to watch because it might make your guys look bad.
Ooh, well said on that last part.
There you go. And you know what? That's what he deserves. I mean, honestly, he's maybe the worst commissioner in all of sports not named Gary Bettman. All right,
and that's hard to do even though we're in the post-Bud C-League world.
Very true. Very true. And again, Gary Bettman still... not very highly regarded in the National Hockey League as well. So, all right, that's it. Good stuff. Thanks to Chris Lemieux joining us today. Thanks, Cushlin. Thanks for the great work on the montage, and thanks to you for listening. We appreciate it. Great stuff once again. Tomorrow, 3 o'clock, we're back at it again for another extravaganza. The Indians and the Tigers back at it tonight. More in-division games, the Indians and the Royals, the Tigers and the Twins. So we'll have a look at Fennec tomorrow. Is he Wednesday?
Wednesday.
We'll get a Tigers update from Fennec on Wednesday, but we'll talk about it with you tomorrow right here on The Ticket. Have a great one.